All right, so here we are with Michael Nygaard at YAL 2012 Australia. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Hey, happy to be here.
Great. So tell us a little bit about your talk and the topic of your talk.
So the first talk that I gave was called Architecture Without an End State. And the premise of that is we shouldn't make these grand visions that turn into posters on the wall and have a three-year plan attached, because we never get to the end of the three-year plan. Something always disrupts it.
Okay.
Business events, you know, mergers, acquisitions, new markets, leaving old markets, or technology change interferes. So what we need to do instead is design architectures that survive continuous change in every part.
Interesting. And so let's kind of take an example of an application, you know, that does something like a web browser, for example, or just some application that has a finite usefulness.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about what an open architecture means in that context.
Yeah, I deal a lot with server-side type of work.
Okay.
So I'll face mostly the enterprise architecture type of questions.
Okay.
A typical application there has kind of a closed set of features that it implements and a closed data set that it works on. And so we sometimes call this a single system of record, or we say it's the authority for a particular set of features.
Mm.
But I think that gets broken or at least challenged in a couple of different ways. One is, as the single system of record, it has to choose certain ideas to bundle together. So an example from the retail space that I've dealt in a lot is the notion of a SKU. And so you'll have systems like, you know, a PIM or an MDM that has an idea of a SKU as a bundle of different attributes. It can be sold, it has weight and size, it has a cost and a price, some descriptive attributes, and so on. When you choose those attributes to bundle together, you're also choosing what to exclude. So the notion of a SKU doesn't allow you to track individual items being purchased. You have to have one SKU for each combination of those attributes. So you can imagine a situation where maybe a retailer wants to start selling digital downloads, where things have to be tracked per buyer, not just by the type of a thing. So the idea of the SKU starts to get challenged then, because the multiplicity breaks down. Another way that it can get challenged is with those attributes. So I had a situation where a client of mine was making a partnership with a home renovation company that had a lot of different screws. And if you tried to represent every screw type as a SKU type, you'd end up with the Cartesian product of every finish, thread density, head shape, and length of screw. And so you'd have 16 million SKUs to represent these pieces of hardware. That would have actually been like 16 times the number of SKUs that they had for everything else they sold, just for different variations of screw. So that would be an example of kind of a closed world assumption about that system falling apart.
Mm.
And so I say, instead of looking for the single system of record, you need to think about a federation of authorities where certain systems are authoritative over an extent of data as well as the attributes of that extent. So think of it, you know, as the depth of the table and the width of the table. That's one kind of authority. And then you have ways of linking authorities together. This allows you to have maybe more than one authority for a type of item, or it allows you to have different authorities for different aspects of an item.
Interesting. So when did you sort of start thinking about this? That's my question. When did this come to you?
Well, it's been gestating for quite a while.
Okay.
In a sense, this is an argument in absentia with a certain type of enterprise architect.
Ah, okay.
So I've dealt with... my background has been with large organizations moving onto the web, and they view it as kind of a web project, but it's really an enterprise integration project with an HTML veneer on the front end.
Okay.
And a lot of the old assumptions about how you build the enterprise architecture are harder to sustain in the face of the web traffic.
Okay. Now, one of the other things that we clearly has been talked about a lot at this event is the notion of continuous delivery and the ability to quickly update things. So in your world, How does that fit into your world? So if I'm building an open-ended architecture in the sense that there is no end game, but I also want my architecture to be resilient in the sense of I need to update pieces of it, you know, very, very often, because now I've opened myself up to the web, and web users expect constant change,
right?
Consistent change in addition to features and stuff. So how do the enterprise types take to that sort of new world? And how does that influence your architecture?
I think they can dovetail together.
Okay.
The enterprise architect types definitely embrace the idea that change needs to be continuous. They're not necessarily on board with continuous delivery within a single system, but the idea that the ecosystem of systems you've got changes over time is, it's just obvious, right?
Sure.
We all have to deal with that. And so I think what I'm talking about is how do you sustain component-wise change or change of the individual systems over long spans of time? And continuous delivery is a way of, I guess, operating at a shorter time scale for delivering those individual systems. So I think they work together.
Okay. So what's the wrong way to design your architecture?
The wrong way.
I can't essentially know that there's not going to be an end game.
Right.
Like, I think I'm always going to be selling the same thing, and I'm always going to have the same products.
Right.
So yeah. I'm going to design my system that way. But that's wrong.
Well, so I think the absolute wrong way, wrong in every respect, would be pick all your technologies up front, decide on a particular architectural style, say layers. You know, we're going to use layers everywhere. We're going to use Model View Controller for those layers everywhere. And it's all going to be one kind of database underneath and one kind of integration technology to connect things. And furthermore, I'm going to embark on an enterprise data modeling project where I'm going to define, you know, what a customer is for everyone. And everyone's going to use the same definition. Mm. I'm going to define, you know, every concept in my enterprise precisely and once and for all. That would sort of be the polar opposite of what I'm talking about in every way.
Okay. And so let's talk about the case where I do have an enterprise system where I have customers and I have products and I have regions and I have prices and I have blah, blah, blah. How do I do it correctly?
First of all, in terms of writing the logic of your application, I recommend something called the hexagonal architecture. Jim Koplin started writing about this quite a few years back. He's renamed it ports and adapters, but I still like the term hexagonal because it's more tangible and, I guess, stickier.
Okay.
The idea in a hexagonal architecture is I write my core domain logic independent of any integration technology, storage technology, or UI technology.
Okay.
It's expressed purely in terms of the domain objects. This would work really well with Eric Evans' domain-driven design approach, too. Around that, I have an outer boundary where I'm interfacing with people, users and administrators. I'm interfacing with monitoring systems. I'm sending events. I'm receiving events. I'm writing to databases and reading from databases. At that periphery or the outer boundary, I'm using technology domain objects. So I'm using concepts like row and table and event. At the inner boundary, I'm using domain-specific objects. And between those two, I have adapters. Each adapter you can think of as a small layered stack that translates from the technology domain to the business domain.
Interesting. So if I'm, you know, here's one of the things. I mean, we see it certainly at conferences like this and in technology in general. It tends to be sort of a fashion-driven discipline in software. So, you know, graph databases. You know, here I am, I have this enterprise. What kind of database makes sense for me? Do I use a traditional object, you know, a relational database? Do I do it all, this NoSQL thing that I hear about? How do you go in and talk to people and figure out what's the right approach for their storage solution? And how does that storage solution relate to an open architecture? If I make the decision on...
The first part I would say is it's important to isolate failure domains. So if you're making a bet on a storage technology, you want to make sure that that bet is survivable and recoverable. So if you need to change out of it later, you should make sure you can do that. Now, I don't mean doing that by writing elaborate isolation layers. But I do mean if my system owns its own database, no one else gets access to it. That's sort of obvious bread and butter enterprise architecture stuff.
Mm. Okay.
So that's step one. Step two, there is a sort of notion of the natural expression for a problem. So if I have a problem that's all about relationships and traversing relationships, a graph database may make sense. If I have a problem that's really about sets and set operations and unions of sets, mm-hmm. then relational is still king there.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say that I come in with, you know, an approach or a description.
Mm-hmm.
What I am going to do is at the outer layer of that decision, so whatever my application is sitting on top of that data store, at the outer layer, I'm going to make sure that we're focusing on link relation types, representations, media types, and so on, so that I'm building the lingua franca of my enterprise in a way that's independent of the storage technology underneath that specific application.
Interesting. So in your world, I mean, because you deal with enterprises, and enterprises tend to like to keep their enterprise software close to home, mm-hmm. right? So on-premise. Now we live in the world of cloud computing, and hey, you don't need an IT infrastructure because you can just do things in the cloud and we'll manage all of the kind of mundane things for you. For you as an enterprise architect, how has this sort of advent of cloud computing as it exists today, how does it impact the way that you go in and try to convince people or teach people how to architect a system? Because you don't always need to have on-premise services.
You don't, that's true. The days of server hugging are sort of waning behind us.
Yeah.
The good news is most of the people I'm talking to these days are already kind of on board with the cloud and they want to move into it. So
awesome.
a lot of those you know, security fears and the FUD factor has really gone away in the last few years.
Okay.
What I do see is people don't know how to move part of their enterprise out there. Because, you know, every system is connected to dozens of other systems. And so if you move one thing out there, now all of a sudden you've got ridiculous amounts of network traffic at much higher latency with either tunneling or, you know, elaborate firewall rules to get it to work.
Mm.
So it's sort of like, you know, the application can move, but its integrations to everything else are trying to, it's like an elastic band trying to snap it back together wherever the majority is.
Okay.
There's a guy named Dave McCrory who coined the term data gravity.
Hmm.
This also plays in. If you've got large enterprise databases, that tends to create a gravity well that will attract applications to where that data lives. And so one of the key challenges in moving out to the cloud is, you know, how do you make that move in a recoverable and survivable way?
Absolutely. Interesting. And, you know, you must encounter lots of clients who have, you know, and I don't, you know, there's really no other term to use. It's an unfortunate term, but legacy. That have legacy systems, and they call you in and are like, hey man, we want to modernize and we want to be open-ended. We don't think our architecture is going to scale to the market and things are changing too fast. Help us. Like, how do you approach that type of problem?
So first, a little digression on the word legacy.
Okay.
I'm finding legacy systems that were written in 2008 and 2009, right? Enterprises are being weighed down by monolithic applications that they built in the middle part of the last decade that are no longer sort of the current style. You know, we're trending more towards services and even microservices rather than, you know, big application containers with everything stuffed inside the container.
Mm.
So legacy doesn't necessarily mean big iron, you know, Oracle databases with COBOL running on top of them or things like that. Legacy can mean, you know, giant Java EE stuff running on WebSphere, WebLogic, you name it.
Mm.
Always the way to approach it is by applying a fairly similar set of patterns. So one pattern is called the strangling vine. I like this one because it's a nice evocative name.
Mm-hmm.
The idea with the strangling vine is you start off by creating a dumb proxy around the old system, and you gradually add features to the proxy and migrate things from the core system out to the proxy until it starts taking over for whatever the old system was doing.
Mm.
And then hopefully you haven't just recreated a new monolith in the proxy, but you've separated things into smaller, more manageable pieces.
Okay.
So that's one kind of pattern. Another kind of pattern is, you know, the parallel build or the augmentation. Augmentation means I've got a new system that has linked data with the old system. So whatever the identifiers were, I've got, you know, identifiers that I can connect, but the new system knows things that the old system doesn't. Mm. And there again, you can sort of gradually replace with the new system.
Okay.
The one thing that I don't see anyone having an appetite for lately is sort of the big bang rebuild. I haven't run into anyone in the last couple of years that wants to invest capital and years in rebuilding and throwing a big crossbar switch.
Hmm. But I mean, in some sense, aren't there cases where that's the right thing to do?
I mean, sometimes potentially. Okay. I mean, you can see cases where the cost of the migration exceeds the cost of the new build. You have to factor in the treadmill factor, though. While you're building the new thing, somebody's probably adding features or building things into the old one as well. So
sure.
you kind of have to build the parity and whatever was incrementally added while you were building parity.
Okay.
And then there's also the notion of just the time value of money and when you're going to see return from the investment you're making. So if it takes a year to reach parity with the legacy system, then any gains you're creating are delayed by a year, and they're worth less because of that. Mm. Not worthless, but you know,
worth less
than they would have been.
Okay. So, I mean, really what it sounds like we're talking about here is designing for the future and designing for the unknown future.
Yes.
And that seems to me to be something that software engineers... That's not something that comes to us innately. It's because
right.
we're fearful
yeah.
of the
We have
future.
This fallacy of omniscience. Like we, you know, we build in mechanisms for variation, right? Think about adding an abstract class with polymorphic hooks. So, you know, if the customer chooses or changes their mind in the future, I can just add a new subclass and be done.
Okay. Right?
We build a lot of speculative generalization to protect ourselves, but we still assume we know what the kind of variation is going to be. And that's a problem.
Yep.
So I try to draw more from the field of complex adaptive systems.
Mm.
And in that field, the idea is you don't know which option of many different potential options is going to survive. And so you don't put all of your resources behind one. You put, you know, a fraction of your resources behind many different alternatives, and then whichever ones are succeeding, you invest more in. This is kind of backwards from the way we do a lot of enterprise systems where, you know, the most challenged projects, the ones that are in trouble and going over budget, we pour more resources into those. Instead of finding the ones that have, you know, great return and very little investment going in and seeing how we can double down on that.
Absolutely. Interesting. Now, I was talking to Fred George today, the programmer Anarchy, and the model that he uses and is evangelizing is very, very, very small. So very small, lightweight, loosely coupled applications.
Yes.
And you just shoot them out as fast as you can. And if they work, they work. If they don't, they don't. You just keep on experimenting. You just keep. It's like a gun where you just keep shooting out all these little balls.
Right.
And to me, that's interesting in the sense of being able to update features quickly. So you can update your kitchen. You don't have to blow your house up.
Right.
Right? And then
yep.
rebuild the whole thing. Now, that I mean, I wonder if that sort of mentality could work in an enterprise-y sort of environment where you're building these loosely coupled, small, digestible components in your architecture so that you can just pull one out, replace it. Ah, it didn't work. No worry. Didn't hurt our business. So let me try to spit out my question, which you probably already were waiting for me to ask because you already know what it is. But can that sort of mentality, that sort of methodology apply to what you do?
Fred and I see a lot of things the same way.
Okay.
So the short answer is yes.
Okay.
The more nuanced answer is Fred is exploring the sort of lower bound of how small a service can be and still do something. So he's talking about, you know, having 10,000 services that are each 100 lines long, which is fantastic. I mean, I really want to see how that turns out. I think the services that I'm looking at are generally a little bit larger. They do a little bit more. But there's still more towards that small end of microservices, and especially towards the idea that instead of maintaining something, I should be able to discard it and rebuild it. So there's another guy here, Dan North, who also talks about being embedded in an environment where they would rewrite applications three or four times before they felt like it was good enough to stick around a while.
Okay.
And even then, once that application is no longer a good fit, they throw it away, delete the code, and build a new one.
Interesting.
Now, the prerequisite in order to do this is an architecture that allows you to build small things and have them communicate with each other through coupling to the environment rather than coupling to each other. And by that I mean some kind of message passing or shared information space.
Sure.
You know, think about bees communicating with each other through the honeycomb. You know, we need small services that can leave chemical messages for other small services rather than directly invoking each other.
Interesting. I mean, that's sort of like the Gremlins model for in the graphing database and the graphing theory. Talking to Marco the other day, I mean, basically, Gremlin is the programming language that sends out all these gremlins onto vertices to do their computation and analysis, and they communicate back not to each other but to a state, some sort of state table, or I can't remember the name of the data structure, but you can understand what it could be.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that one, but that's a great example.
That's an interesting.
I would say, you know, tuple spaces are another way of accomplishing the same thing.
Awesome. Very, very cool. So what are some of the biggest, now we're going to get into the part of the interview where we talk big picture. What's the biggest problem in your space that keeps you up at night? I mean, you're an enterprise architect, man.
I think the biggest problem that keeps me awake is the breakdown of IT as a department. That the way IT has been formulated for the past couple of decades just doesn't make sense anymore. And it can't continue the way it has been.
Okay.
I think what we're going to see is IT is going to be held responsible more for keeping a platform alive rather than building all the applications that an enterprise needs to live on. If you think about an IT group as an internal cloud provider, that's more the boundary of responsibility that we're going to see going forward. The things that are pulling more responsibility in are compliance, regulatory, and security concerns. And that's an unbearable tension in a lot of organizations right now. The centralization of development into IT has caused application delivery to be so slow that business units are very commonly going outside of their company to get things done.
Wow.
I mean, we see this with the bring your own device to work, right?
Yes.
I mean, who's getting issued tablets by their company? Almost no one. Who's got them inside their company? Almost everyone.
Yes.
We see it with cloud services. I'm willing to bet way more cloud services are being purchased with, you know, like secretarial purchasing cards at the departmental level than by IT departments. And so it's sort of like the boundaries of the firm are being challenged by the fact that IT is slow and expensive relative to going outside.
Yep.
Even though going outside does still carry some risks around compliance and control. I saw an article not long ago about something like 1 in 5 corporate users are using Dropbox.
Wow.
Even though it's more or less explicitly forbidden by every corporate information security policy. you know, the higher you go in the org chart, the more ubiquitous the use of Dropbox becomes, even among people who, you know, theoretically should be the backers of the policy.
Sure. Well, I mean, let's be honest. I think if you look at, you know, how modern times is impacting software. So let's look at software engineers and, you know, IT pros is what we call them. I mean, they're all, you're all engineers, but you have the people who write code for a living, and you have people who, one could argue, are writing scripts and they're designing systems and they're managing machines. I mean, I'm not an IT pro, so I'm kind of winging it on that, but I know lots of IT pros. They're very smart. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, they're computer people. They're technologists. And we're looking, we see a renaissance in software development where we have these new methodologies, agile and lean and blah, blah, blah. All very interesting. But for IT pro, there also is some sense the notion of lean and agile and
non-monolithic.
There you go. Yes. DevOps. There's another word, buzzword. So let's talk about that.
Okay. So first of all, in my comments about IT in general, I think that the key disconnects are really around budgeting cycles and sort of the pace of change.
Okay.
Because with the software engineers, you know, if you and I sat down over beers and came up with a great idea for software as a service, we would write it, we'd spin it up in a cloud, we'd be up and running in 48 hours or so. Mm-hmm. And we've got all these, you know, weekend events, Rails Rumble and Node Knockout and so on, that are all about like extremely rapid delivery. And that's realistic. You can actually do that and create something valuable and meaningful. And then if corporate IT is going to support it, it has to wait for next year's budget cycle, and somebody has to champion it and put in for a capital allocation and, you know, make sure that it, whatever it is, survives all the way through the budgeting process. And so there's kind of an average 6 month delay built in to the annual budget cycle. So I'm never attributing any slowness to the individuals because, you know, as you say, we're all engineers, we're all technologists. Most of us believe that technology can solve problems. but we're embedded in systems, right? So you don't blame the person, you blame the system they're embedded in.
Understood. Now, the system you're embedded in terms of budgetary constraints, I mean, when the cloud computing craze first started, and I'm talking about when the sort of the big players started pushing this notion of the removal of IT from corporations in general and moving it outside of the corporation, that was a cost-cutting measure for the corporation in addition to a management, cutting down management. So, you know, talking about budget, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, you know, we have all these methodologies for software developers about this is how you ship fast, or this is how you can be productive and ship. And make your customers happy. The management, the bill payers, the pencil people, they're the one. They're still going to want to know how is this going to impact our bottom line, right? So
yeah,
they're
going to
have budgetary concerns. So for the IT pro, he's like, look, you know, do the IT pros can come back into their org and say we really should, you know, think about modifying our architecture to be more open-ended and agile and lean. You know, throw some terms out there, and then explain what that means. So I guess what I'm trying to ask is, what does lean mean in an enterprise architecture scenario such that the company can save money? Because companies are all about money, man.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely
the way it works. So they can save money, which means they have more profit, and also still have an IT department, but also, more importantly, still have an IT infrastructure, because that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And that's their golden nuggets, or that's their thing. So how do you do that? I want to be lean and mean.
Right. So part of it is that you have to create your own infrastructure for rapid change and deployment.
Okay.
So this is where DevOps comes in, and it's where private cloud comes in, and platform as a service comes in. So the orgs that you see adopting these technologies and creating their own platforms will be faster. And faster translates directly into money as well. In fact, in most cases, the best way to save money is just get things done faster.
Okay. Right?
Like get the project off your plate so you're not burning the burn rate every month. So that's going to be, you know, a combination of infrastructure architecture, IT operations, and enterprise architecture collaborating to define what the platform needs to be, who has access to it, what the monitoring and metering tools are going to be like, what the supported languages and libraries and data stores and so on are going to be. But I think we see some very interesting things happening now with the platform as a service open source community, as well as the commercial offers from VMware and Microsoft.
Excellent. And of course, there's also infrastructure as a service.
Yes.
Are you seeing, this is actually something I've been thinking about, and you would know since this is the world you live in, are there any instances that you know of where a company has made a full bet on the cloud? So platform as a service, infrastructure mm-hmm. as a service, somebody else manages all this database as a service, I'm using SQL Azure, I'm using something in a virtual machine for an EC2, whatever. I'm going cloud pure. Have you seen that?
The poster child for that type of thing is Netflix. So they were physically hosted at one point in time, and they started moving everything into the cloud several years ago. And I heard recently that they shut off the last machine they had in their data center this year.
Wow.
So they've been moving in that direction for a long time and learning a lot about what it means to build resilient architectures in the cloud. Because you don't get better reliability by adding more moving parts underneath your application, right?
Yeah.
The cloud environments, you have to build reliability on top of whatever cloud you're running on. Mm. So Netflix learned a lot about that. They've been publishing a lot of components as open source, and they're really kind of the poster children.
That's really interesting because they certainly do a lot of transactions and generate a lot of data.
Yeah, what is it, 40% of all the bandwidth on the internet is streaming movies from Netflix?
Crazy, crazy, crazy. Now, just to kind of go back to your original comment about sort of the thing that keeps you up at night, what happened, I mean, in some sense, what does an IT pro at Netflix do?
Netflix is a little unusual in the way they're approaching operations.
Okay.
So they have talked about no ops. This is a term I don't personally agree with, but I'll try and represent it. So for them, the developers who build a service are also accountable for the operation of the service, meaning they get woken up at night, there's pager rotation, and you really have to, you know, keep an eye on the performance and availability characteristics of everything you create. Mm. What's interesting there is you can easily imagine scenarios where one team alone can't solve a problem. And that's where, you know, we've typically relied on an operations group to have visibility across many applications and many layers of the infrastructure to be able to say, you know, is this a network problem? Is it a database problem? Is it a failed disk drive? Mm. Regardless of where the symptoms may be showing up, that they can drill back to root cause. So I'm not actually sure how well the NoOps idea is going to play out there. I think what it really means is you're growing developers who also have the skills of an operator.
Okay, interesting. Now, when you were talking, I was the kind of visualizing a modern automobile plant where there are humans, but the humans are outnumbered by the robots because the robots can very efficiently put large pieces onto cars going through a line of you know, whatever that's called, assembly mm-hmm. line. And in some sense, isn't that sort of what's happening? And we're moving in that, in the IT world, we're sort of moving into that space. Machines will be, so when you think about these big data centers, mm-hmm. they're not full of humans.
No, that's right. In fact, the ratio has gotten lower and lower every year.
So at some point, you know, your point is very well taken because I don't think it's fair to assume that a software developer should also be, you know, I should write, clearly you have to write your unit tests, you have to optimize your code, you have to do the things that a developer does. Now I'm a developer, I'm a tester, and now I have to, in this world of like, shoot things out as fast as you can, now I'm like a PM, so I have to design features and shoot them up and see if they work. And now I'm also going to be an IT pro, an IT guy. I think that's kind of crazy. And I hope it doesn't go that way.
Well, this is the reason that I like the boundary being the platform as a service.
Okay.
So you mentioned infrastructure as a service a few minutes ago. And for me, the key problem there is with infrastructure as a service, the thing that you receive is still a virtual machine. You log in, you're root or administrator, you install a bunch of stuff, you configure a bunch of stuff. And that's a particular skill set that's always been in the IT admin space rather than developers. Mm. Developers can do it. A lot of us are admin on our own machines, right?
Sure.
But there's a different way of looking at it. I think with platform as a service, we've got a better a better boundary layer, because the thing that you're delivering is not, you know, chef scripts or puppet scripts or a playbook of installation instructions. What you're delivering is a software artifact, sort of in the language of your platform, right? You're delivering an MSI, you're delivering assemblies, you're delivering tarballs or jar files, and then the platform takes care of provisioning what's needed and running it. And the IT pros keep the platform running, the developers keep continuous integration going and delivering those artifacts to the platform. Mm. So to me, that's a more tenable boundary layer than infrastructure as a service, where you've got developers writing chef scripts and things like that.
Interesting, interesting. So, you know, the final question I'll ask you is, I mean, where do you think this is going to be in 5 years? So, the man who doesn't like to build endgame systems,
right.
What's the endgame in 5 years?
Well, I won't call it an endgame, but I will say my picture of where things are in 5 years is that IT is responsible for running a platform.
Okay.
That platform may be self-hosted, or it may be bridged out to a public cloud, but the interface is going to be that platform as a service. Development and applications is going to decentralize. It's going to move back out into business units where it hasn't already done so. Mm. And you're going to see more rapid change of smaller units of code and business units tied together and aligned, integrated through a platform and a shared information space.
Excellent, man. Well, if I see you again in 5 years, we'll see if this was right, because we have it on tape, man.
Predictions are notoriously difficult, but it's December, so.
Right on. And it's summer.
Yeah, it's summer here. Yeah.
That's right on. All right, and New Zealand, forgive me. Rock and roll. Great to talk to you. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
Thanks. Glad to be here.